Number three is receiving gifts. We're talking about the languages of love. Your language is not the same, primarily, as the love language of your spouse, although I heard of one person over the lunch hour who thinks they're a little high maintenance and they want all of these things. Really, we each have one of these, or maybe a couple of them, that are primary. We may all want them all, but we have some that are more important to us than others, and in many cases there may be circumstances where some of them don't mean as much to you as they would to somebody else. That's why we're trying to sort these things out. Some sort of gift giving seems to be an inherent part of every culture. The trips I've made over to the Philippines, this becomes very evident so far as their culture is concerned. They love to give and receive gifts. They do it when you get together, they do it when you leave, and it's a can almost in some ways be a burdensome part of the culture, I would think, if you were involved in that all the time. But you do need to be thinking of somebody in order to give them a gift, and that's the idea. The gift itself is a symbol of your thought. Mothers, I think, all probably remember when their child brings them a flower out of the yard. They've been outside playing, and here comes this little hand. Even if it was a flower you didn't want picked, here comes this little hand toward you. Mama, I picked this for you. And your heart just melts, and you get a vase and put it in water and put it on the table as a reminder of the expression of love from your child when they gave you that gift, because gifts are visible symbols of love. Most weddings include the giving and the receiving of rings, an outward and visible sign of an inward and wonderful gift, as we sometimes say. Symbols have an emotional value, but these symbols are a lot more important to some people than they are to others. Giving gifts is one of the easiest love languages to learn. If your spouse's primary love language is the giving of gifts, that's a good thing for you, probably, because it's relatively easy among these languages to learn. If you have trouble knowing what to give, then you need to just think through the whole range of possibilities. A gift can be purchased or found or made. You can purchase a beautiful greeting card for just a few dollars, and to some people that means a great deal. You can make a card for nothing if a card is important to your loved ones. You need to determine whether it's important to them or not. For some people, it's not. They'll open up a card and think it's nice, but it really doesn't have any meaning to them. To some other people, it means a great deal. Now, if you have trouble knowing what to give, make a list of all the gifts your spouse has expressed excitement about receiving over the years, given by you or by other people. And I think that gives you an insight into the kinds of things that he or she would enjoy receiving. If, on the other hand, she has been critical of your gifts in the past and almost nothing you've given has seemed to be acceptable, it may be that the receiving of gifts is not her primary love language. My wife told me that she got sucked into a conversation over the lunch hour that had to do with which one of these love languages was going to include the part about money. So I don't want to disappoint, and this would be a good place to include talking about money right now, since we're talking about receiving, the receiving of gifts. We each have our individual perceptions about money and what's best to do with it, the purposes of money. We've each got emotions that are connected with spending and spending habits. Some of us have a pretty general spending orientation toward money. Others have a more saving and investing type of orientation. People who have a spending orientation feel good when they're spending. Now, if you're a spender, you're not going to have much difficulty with the idea of purchasing gifts for your spouse, because you're going to probably waste it on something else anyway. So you don't have any problem with just spending your money away, no matter how much or how little you have, if you are a spender by nature. And there are a lot of people that way. Other people, though, have this saving and investing sort of perspective. They feel good when they're saving and investing, and spending is uncomfortable for them. Please try to understand each other, because you may be poles apart on this. As a matter of fact, in a marriage, the opposites of this on this subject do tend to attract. It's a rather amazing thing to think about. And I'll just briefly diagram this on the board. If this is normal when it comes to spending and saving, if you're just kind of neutral on that, then this is the whole range of infinite possibilities. If you are normal in spending and saving, and maybe you like to do a little of each, then maybe you'll marry somebody that's normal, and you can live happily ever after because you both look at it the same way.
But few people are precisely normal, whatever normal is here. And so maybe I'm a little bit over on this side. And I'm going to try to probably marry somebody. Subconsciously, I seek out somebody to marry who's a little bit off of center in the other direction, because I'm looking for somebody who's strong where I'm weak. I'm looking for somebody different than I am. I need somebody that the knots on my head will fit into the holes in her head. So this automatically is what we seek for. I don't think we realize that that's what's going on when we're looking to get married. It's only later on we figure out how different we are, and we can think, how could I have married somebody who's so different from me? We've got virtually nothing in common. If you happen to be extreme, you may marry somebody who's way over here. And then you can spend the rest of your life wondering, how could we be so different from each other? But you need to try to come to terms. And I think probably if you are the extremes, both of you tend, over time, hopefully, as you love one another, you tend to move in the direction of your loved one, so that eventually you get to a happy center and you realize there is a reason to be different from what I used to be in this area. All of this is involved when we talk about spending for the family, and especially maybe spending on each other. If you're a saver, you may have some emotional resistance to the idea of spending money as an expression of love. After all, if it's love, it can't be bought with money. I feel cheapened. I feel like it's fake if I would spend money as an expression of love. But if you discover that your spouse's primary love language is receiving gifts, then you may come to understand that purchasing gifts is one of the best investments that you can make. It may not make more money for you, but it is still one of the best investments that you could possibly make, because you're investing in your relationship. You're filling your spouse's emotional love tank. And with a love tank that's full, he or she may reciprocate to you in a language that you yourself will understand. What good is it going to do for you to wind up as a millionaire if you're all by yourself? You didn't want to be by yourself, or you wouldn't have gotten married. When both of your emotional needs are met, your relationship will take on a whole new dimension. Not that you're going to have a complete personality change. If you're a saver, you're always going to be a saver, and your spouse will probably learn to love that about you, because after all, it's their future that you're saving for too. But you can't make a better investment than investing in loving your spouse, whatever that means in your relationship. There's also the intangible gift of self, or the gift of your presence, we might call it. In other words, being there. Being there at crucial moments in life means a great deal to some people. Other people, it doesn't mean so much. But there are people that need for you to be there, just to have your physical presence there at certain points in their life. And that speaks very loudly to somebody whose primary love language is receiving gifts many times. The physical presence in times of crisis tends to be very important to such a person. Your presence is the symbol of your love. Remove the symbol of your love, which is your presence, and the sense of love tends to evaporate. Now, if your physical presence is important to your spouse, then you need to, if your spouse's physical presence is important to you, you need to verbalize that to your spouse, because otherwise they might not know it. It's very important that we don't expect our spouse to read our minds. They're not like us. They're different in many ways. There's no should be no shame in telling your spouse what you need from them. And if they love you, then they're going to try to provide that. But they don't automatically know. So many younger people especially will think, well, if he really loved me, he'd just know. I shouldn't have to tell him. There's some pride involved in not wanting to have to tell him what you need. But you do need to be his main educator about what you need, because it's not going to come automatically. You shouldn't expect him to read your mind. If your spouse says, I really want you to be there with me at this particular occasion, I don't care if it's a wedding, a funeral, or in the hospital, whatever it is, I really want you to be there with me for that, then you should take that request seriously. From your perspective, it might not seem very important. But if you don't go, it may be sending a message that you don't intend to send, because obviously it's important to them, or they wouldn't be requesting your presence. At the heart of love is this spirit of giving. All the five love languages involve giving. But to some people, receiving gifts
or as visible symbols of love, speaks the loudest to them. And learning the right love language is the key, or a key, to helping your spouse feel loved. So that's probably the main thing I'll say about money. The next area was brought up at lunch, too. Somebody asked if pork chops were going to be on the list. And the pork chops fit under this next one as a general category. Acts of service. Cooking a nice meal is one of many acts of service that may be your spouse's primary love language. Doing things that you know your spouse would like for you to do. It can be mowing the yard, cooking a meal, like Jesus washing the disciples' feet that needed to be done. He knelt down and did it. Serving one another in love. That's the idea here. In order to train one another in this area, we need to make requests rather than demands. If somebody is responding to a demand, you may get the job done, but it's not as likely to be done with anything other than a grudging spirit. And that's not the tenor that we want in our home. Criticism and demands tend to drive wedges between us. With enough criticism, your spouse may do what you want, but it probably won't be as an expression of love. You can't create the will to love. Each of us has to decide regularly whether to love or not where our spouse is concerned. We're told to do it. We know we should do it. We need to do it. But we each decide whether we're going to do it or not. If we choose to love, then expressing it in the way our spouse requests will make our love most effective emotionally. We can't make a demand and then really feel all that great about it even when the demand is met, because it started off on a wrong basis. But when we make a request, that can give a true direction to love. And we can ask one another if we don't know, what nice thing can I do for you today? And that may elicit a request. Whereas demands tend to stop the flow of love. What we do for one another before marriage is no indication at all of what we're going to do for one another after marriage, because it just seems different. It looks different after marriage. Before marriage, we're carried along by that feeling of being in love. After marriage, we tend to revert to being the people we were before we, quote, fell in love. So our actions are influenced by a lot of different things, factors in our lives. They're influenced by the way our parents related to each other. Our actions are influenced by our own DNA, our own personality, our own perceptions of love, our desires, needs, emotions, etc. Only one thing is certain about our behavior. It's not going to be the same as it was when we were caught up with being in love. In the traditional courtly love sense that we commonly use that expression in our society for the past couple of hundred years. I can remember when we weren't married yet, but we were going with each other, I was in way up north somewhere, and it must have been midnight, and I called Lynn on the phone. She was way out in Kansas, and I called her on the phone, and this conversation, it just enthralled me so much that as soon as I hung up the phone, I told the people I was staying with, I'm not going to stay here tonight after all, and I drove through the night all the way just to get to the one I loved. Well, that's good and appropriate at the time, but I don't do that very often anymore. I'm just tired now. No, it's just not quite the same. We go on from that to a love that is richer, fuller, deeper, as the song said. We're like the flowers, and they look a certain way for a while, but then they go on to the more interesting and lasting obligation of reproducing themselves and go to other layers of fulfillment of their responsibilities. So there are these changes over time. These acts of service that we're talking about can help us to grow deeper into love with one another and have a relationship that is even greater than it was back at those original times. My spouse's criticisms about my behavior provide me with the clearest clues to her primary love language. Like somebody was saying at the lunch hour, we do our own love language. We talk our own love language to other people. Those notes in the luggage that I got were because Lynn was interested in getting that kind of notes. And the chances are, if your spouse is criticizing your behavior, they're criticizing in the area of their love language because they feel like you're not fulfilling it. People tend to criticize their spouse most loudly in the area where they themselves have the deepest emotional need. Their criticism is sometimes an ineffective way of pleading for love, but it is a pleading for love and should be recognized as that no matter how bad it seems. We should recognize it for what it truly is. And if we do understand that, it may help us to process their criticism of us in a more productive way and allow something good to come out of it. Criticism in a marriage often needs clarification. Very often, it's a good thing that criticism is happening, but it could be put in a better way. So let's try to pretend that our spouse did put it in the best possible way and learn what we can from their criticism of us. If we initiate a conversation about that, it may eventually turn what started as a criticism into a request rather than a demand, and a lot of good can come from it. I'm certainly not recommending that anybody become a doormat in their marriage. I don't think that's good. It's not healthy. A doormat can serve you, but it never will love you. Manipulation by guilt will never do any good. If you were a good husband, you'd do this for me. That'll never do anybody any good. That's not a language of love. Coercion by fear, you do this for me or else. That's not going to do anybody any good. That's not a language of love. Acts of service are, and if your language is acts of service, learn to make requests in a loving way. And if your partner has acts of service as their love language, then by all means try to fulfill that. I'll mention the final one here, and that is physical touch. Physical touch is a way of communicating love, emotional love. We can talk about this in relation to children for a long time. Children coming into the world need to be touched. Little children growing up in our families need to be poked in the ribs. They need to be tickled and wrestled and have an arm around them occasionally. And it seems like sometimes the older they get, the less we tend to touch them. But we still need to touch those children, I think, as long as they're in our home, if not even longer than that. For some people, physical touch is their primary language of love. Without it, they just do not feel like everything's complete. They don't feel connected. They tend to feel unloved without it. But with it, they feel secure in the love of their spouse. Now, since we're talking about physical touch, I should just briefly mention that sexual intercourse is one dialect of this fifth point. But we have to be careful with this, because a lot of men jump to the conclusion when they see this list that, well, my language must be physical touch since I'm so desirous of sexual intercourse, when really their language may be something entirely different. Basically, with physical touch, we're not talking about sexuality, although that can be included as one dialect of it. But bear in mind that there are receptors all over the body, even though they're not evenly spread. And touch anywhere on the body can communicate love or hate. A slap in the face, I feel, is detrimental to any child. There is a portion of the child sufficiently padded for the spanking that the book of Proverbs recommends so highly. But to slap a child in the face, I think, is detrimental. And it probably is devastating, in particular, to a child whose primary love language is physical touch. On the other hand, a hug communicates love to any child, but to a child whose language is physical touch, it especially shouts that they are loved. Lovingly touching your spouse almost anywhere on their body can be perceived as an expression of love. Not all touches are created equal. Some will bring more pleasure to your spouse than others, and your best instructor is your spouse. She or he is the one that you're seeking to show your love to, and they know best what they perceive as a loving touch. Learn to speak their particular love dialect. Some touches are uncomfortable. Some of them are even irritating. So don't make the mistake of thinking that the touch that brings you pleasure will also bring pleasure to them. Some touches require only a moment. It's like an arm around the shoulders or a touch to the face. And others, like a back rub, are more explicit and may require a lot more energy and full attention. But they still basically involve touch. Implicit love touches require just a little bit of time. But sometimes they require a lot of thought. If physical touch is not your primary love language, you may just plain forget to do it. It's not that you didn't want to hug your wife, you just forgot to do it. And she can't imagine how you could forget anything as important as that. But if it's not your primary love language, you may very easily forget to hug her. You might make a resolution. Well, I'm going to be sure I hug her every day. But then you better put it on your calendar every day if it's hard for you to remember. Because if it's not your personal love language, you may just not think of it. Especially if you get busy or if you didn't grow up in a touching family. Families are a lot different from each other in this. Some families are very, very touchy. And the people that come out of them tend to be that way. They're just huggers by their very nature. Women in particular, across culturally, tend to be huggers. They hug each other, and I've seen that in various parts of the world, as well as in churches everywhere. Men aren't so much that way. A couple of generations ago, it was thought to be a little bit too close to effeminacy if a man was a hugger of any variety. And many men felt that way. The old people in my grandfather's, my great-grandfather's generation, the men that really built this country and had to be strong and couldn't afford, they felt, to show a lot of emotion. You tried to hug those old guys, it was like hugging a rock. I mean, they didn't want anything to do with it. These were the men who never told you they loved you either, because they felt like that if you love somebody, you show it by the way you do toward them. I'm feeding you, that should prove to you I love you. I don't need to tell you I love you. And those old guys, even if you told them that you loved them, it made them very uncomfortable. They couldn't find a way to return it. They might say, well, we love you too, or they'll say, uh-huh, or something like that. But these were wonderful people. I knew a great many of them. A lot of them are dead now. But that was a wonderful generation of people. But they had a little blind spot there, in my opinion. It'll be interesting in a generation or two when the future people find out what our blind spots were in our generation. I'm sure we've got a lot worse ones than some of those folks had. Hugging your wife before she goes shopping may bring her back sooner with more of the money still intact. So there are a variety of reasons for getting interested in this subject. But physical touch is important. Whatever there is of me on earth resides inside of my body. When you touch my body, therefore, in a sense, you're touching me. And to withdraw from my body is to distance yourself from me emotionally. The body is important, biblically speaking. It's an ascetic and leaning toward a Gnostic point of view to say that the body is not important. There is a great importance attached to the body. And what we do with the body always affects our spirit. So there's a close connection there. In our society, shaking hands is the kind of a touch that communicates an openness to another individual. When a man refuses to shake hands with another man, that communicates that things are not right in their relationship with each other. And all societies have some sort of physical touch as a means of social greeting. In Europe, especially traditionally, the bear hug and the kiss serve the same function as shaking hands. I'll never forget how that was brought home to me. We had just gotten a television set. As I recall now, this is the way it went down. We had just gotten a television set, and Nikita Khrushchev was coming over to visit. And as I'm recalling it now, he came down the stairs, the way they used to come off of airplanes, right on the tarmac, came down the stairs, and he grabbed President Eisenhower, gave him a bear hug, and then kissed him on both cheeks. And I'd never seen anything like that between two men in my whole life up to that point. It was right after we got a TV. I was maybe 12 years old or so. I'd never seen anything like that, and it impressed me. But that was just the way of greeting in the country that Premier Khrushchev came from. And he didn't think anything about it. It was a bit of cultural shock for me. So there are differences culturally. There are differences individually. Find out what your spouse's language is in this area of physical touch. Almost instinctively, in times of crisis, we hug one another. I've been hugged in times of crisis by people who do not ordinarily hug. But there's something about it. Physical touch is a powerful communicator of love and sustenance. And I'll throw this out, and I don't know why it took me so long to figure this out. I've told several people at the lunch hour that I think I'm denser than most in this area, and maybe that's one reason it's so interesting to me. But if your wife's primary love language is physical touch, it's imperative that you hold her when she cries. And even if her primary love language is not physical touch, I think you still should hold her when she cries. And you don't have to say anything. Just grab her. I mean, it took me years to figure out that if my wife is upset and she's crying, just grab her. Grab her and hold on to her. And I still don't know why that helps her. But it seems to. And I see other female heads nodding about that. There's something about this that's very important to us, and we dare not give it short shrift. Well, some of you are going to instantaneously know your primary love language and that of your spouse. For others, it's not going to be that easy. If a man does not enjoy physical touch at times other than sexual situations, then his primary love language is probably not physical touch, because sexual desire is quite different from his emotional need to feel loved ordinarily. In other words, sexual things are not alone going to meet his need to feel loved. So his wife has to learn to speak his primary love language as well. When we speak each other's primary love language and we keep each other feeling the love that we feel toward each other, I'm going to just assume, because I want to assume it, that of all the marriages represented here today, we each love each other unconditionally and we plan to keep doing that. But what we need to do is keep each other feeling that love that is actually there. We need to keep that communication open and flowing. And that's why I think it will serve you well to try to figure out what is the primary love language of yourself and what is the primary love language of your spouse, and perhaps discuss this together. Maybe read that book if you want to. And I understand that some of you have already read that book. I think that's a good idea. I've been passing it out lately to couples that I'm about to marry, because I think there's enough in it that's good. You know, it's like a lot of these books on the popular market. There's some very good points marinated in Calvinism, and you need to strain the Calvinism out, of course, but I think generally we're capable of doing that. What does your spouse say or do, or fail to say or do, that hurts you deeply? If you answer that question, then you're well on your way to figuring out what your primary love language is. If your deepest pain is the critical, judgmental words of your spouse, maybe your primary love language is words of affirmation. Your greatest hurt may be the clue to what your love language is. Looking back over your marriage, you might just ask yourself, what have I most often requested of my spouse? What have I nagged about? Nagging is often an effort to get your love language spoken and fulfilled. So examine what you do or say to express love to your spouse. Chances are you're doing for them what you wish they would do for you. That's not always true. Sometimes you're just doing what your role models in life trained you to do, but it's often true. So I think it's a good idea if we each write down what we think our primary love language is, and then write down the other four in importance to us, even if you want them all. Figure out what the order is. And if two of these seem to be very equal in your life, then maybe you are bilingual. Maybe you could be pleased in either one of those two areas, and that should make it easier for your spouse because they have two choices, either one of which will communicate very strongly your love to them. Well, I think that's all I'm going to say at this point. Anybody got anything they wanted to ask or say, any comments or questions along any of these lines this afternoon? All right. Well, I appreciate you sticking with me through that, and I hope it's been beneficial to you. And if not, I'm not sure why not. If it's not beneficial to you, then I hope it's because you already knew all that, because I think there is great value in this information. We're going to conclude this afternoon once again by extending the Lord's invitation, since we never know the hearts of those who are present. If we can assist you in any way, whether it's primary obedience of the gospel or anything that you have as a need on your mind, let us know how we can help you by coming to the front as we stand together and sing the number that Gary's about to lead.